Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Happy President's Day, everyone, and welcome to the special President's Day edition of the podcast. And over the next several minutes, we'll be talking about our personal favorite presidents, our least favorite presidents, and what exactly we'd like to see at the top of the Republican ticket in 2012, who would potentially be, and considering who is currently in the White House, hopefully will be the next president of the United States. And Jim, let's start on the good side. You've got 44 presidents, 43 different men to choose from here. Who's number one on your list?
Well, okay, look, obviously you can go with the very obvious Lincoln, Washington, Reagan. I can hear every one of our listeners yelling out loud right now. But I want to kind of look beyond all that, the obvious choices, the ones that everybody would kind of jump, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, et cetera. I was thinking about in my lifetime, which is obviously not terribly long, and thinking about presidents and how they responded to the crises of the day. There's a part of me that feels like Gerald Ford always belongs in the all-time underrated presidents, because you got to figure about somebody. Look, people mock him as, you know, he was never elected. He was kind of this caretaker president who kind of, if you believe the Chevy Chase impression, he stumbled into office, so to speak. But you think about just the severe breakdown in trust between the American people and its government at that moment, that maybe, you know, the presidency doesn't always need to be this grand war hero conqueror or, you know, hugely ambitious changer of worlds. I mean, at that moment, you could probably argue that America just needed a decent man who they could trust, who was willing to play straight with them. I know a lot of people hold the pardon of Nixon against him, but I think he did effectively end what could have ended up being this, you know, relentless deep sore of Watergate on the country. And there's a part of me that feels like, look, I mean, this is almost separate from many of his policy decisions and his defeat in 1976, but there's a certain decency to the man that I think is sometimes easily forgotten when we're thinking about what presidents ought to be. And if you look at some of the presidents we've had since then and some of the presidents who preceded him, at times decency can be a very underrated value in a president.
I would throw three names out there. Number one is Washington himself, because the Constitution basically designed the executive branch with him as the model in mind. Pretty hard to do better than that. The fact that he didn't want some lofty title, and the fact that he actually gave up power, which was unique then, and it's pretty unique now. I think a lot of the folks who have served under the 22nd Amendment probably would have run again. Clinton certainly would have. George W. maybe not, and who knows if Reagan would have at that age. But definitely setting that precedent was huge. Reagan, obviously, in our lifetime, because when we as conservatives think about what we want in a leader, he's proof that we can actually get it once in a while. Unfortunately, it's more rare than we'd like. We saw flashes of it, certainly, in some other presidents. I'll throw one Democrat out there, not in my lifetime, but in recent history, back when strong national security posture was something to be lauded in both parties, and both parties pursued it, and that's Harry Truman, not only for how he ended World War II, but also instituted the Marshall Plan, which, yeah, was big government. It was big government that actually worked, and it paid off for us in the long run, both in political and economic terms. His Truman Doctrine, helping Greece and Turkey stay democratic and free, and, of course, the Berlin Airlift, keeping that whole situation afloat until finally, 40 years later, we finally got the wall come down. So even in recent times, or going all the way back to the first president, there's definitely people with characteristics worth emulating there. So,
Greg, I just want to point out the headline from all this is going to be Greg Corumbus's favorite presidents are Washington, Reagan, and Truman. Jim's is Gerald Ford.
I think I like my odds on the reaction.
I hope people judge my by the criteria I set out, looking beyond the obvious.
I'm waiting for the angry Martin Van Buren emails, but we'll see. I don't know if there's a lot of fans of his out there still, but let's move on to number two now. Obviously, the worst presidents in our lifetime. We've actually seen a decent number of those, but obviously we still have, again, a great number to choose from. Who's at the bottom of your list?
Again, I wanted to kind of think back to my lifetime. I'll let the historians argue the choices of the first part of the century. And I have a feeling, maybe a better category for this would be overrated. I have a feeling that, you know, many people will think back to the Bill Clinton years as a relative golden age, an era of perceived peace and prosperity, even though the dot-com bubble burst about 10 minutes after he left office and less than a year after he left office with the 9/11 attack, suggesting that there were great gathering menaces to American life in many forms going on during his years. But I think if you look back to the Clinton years, one of the things that feels like a permanent change in our political life, and I would argue a harmful one, is what someone referred to as the Oprahization of the presidency. The idea that this is a the president is now a perceived national father figure. I'm sure right now Jonah Goldberg would have about, 30 minutes worth of material to discuss about that notion. But the idea that president is supposed to open up every aspect of his life, and the president is supposed to emote for us on command, and the idea that the president can sometimes feel, you listen to him and you sometimes feel like he's on a psychiatrist's couch talking about problems in his psyche, et cetera. You don't see any Eisenhower style reserve or any kind of the dignity you think of proceed. Obviously, Reagan refused to take his coat off in the office. Never mind the various things that Bill Clinton did in the Oval Office. So, and it's one of those things where I think even, if you look at George W. Bush, you look at Obama, they both have kind of had this, the expectation is now there is not merely that you should respect your president or agree with your president or disagree with your president, but you have to have some sort of deep emotional bond with the president. And, and people said George W. Bush was someone who they'd like to have a beer with. I'm not sure the president of the United States ought to be someone you want to have a beer with. I'm sure there are a lot of people I wouldn't want to have a beer with who might make fantastic presidents. And there are a lot of people I have great time having beers with who I don't want to be president of the United States. So I kind of feel like Bill Clinton triggered this change in our expectation of the role of president in a way that I think is probably not going to be good for the country moving forward. I think it's something of a lost cause to fight against it. You argue the Oprahization of our culture is pretty darn complete, but I'll be looking for these stiff, uncharismatic, and unemotional presidential candidates in 2012, hoping to restore this archaic notion of reserved presidents in the future, Greg.
Yeah, well, in my lifetime, I obviously am using slightly different criteria. I think it's a horse race, neck and neck sprint down to the wire between Carter and Obama as to which one's going to do the most damage to the country. The good news with Carter is that in addition to having horrific policy ideas, he was also completely ineffective at getting things through a largely Democratic Congress. So I guess he technically did less damage, although if you look at his foreign policy record, we're clearly still dealing with the repercussions of that. If you want to go back to the whole big government parade, you can clearly go back to Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. And many people would say Woodrow Wilson, bringing in his League of Nations type of approach. Everybody kind of decides how the world's going to look, and bringing in the Federal Reserve, bringing in the income tax, all in that time, and it fundamentally changed the way that America functioned, and not necessarily for the better. So that kind of led to what we saw with FDR and his big government grab, which led to LBJ, and then we've just seen it kind of snowball since then, and we got to blame quite a few Republican presidents for adding to the problem, including Nixon, including Bush 1 with his tax cuts, including Bush 43, who didn't raise taxes, but he sure spent way more than he should have. So unfortunately, until very recently, like we've talked about in the last few days, both parties definitely got the bug, and it's been very hard to shake for America, and we're paying the price for it. So,
amen.
On to the third martini now, Jim, and what we want to see in 2012. There's obviously a huge set of issues out there, and we'll probably have a huge field. One of the things we've seen, and we've talked about at least once before, is what exactly ought to be the focal point of the Republican nominee and the Republican Party in 2012. You've got Mitch Daniels, who's widely considered to be considering a presidential run, saying we should call a truce on social issues, something that obviously social conservatives are not happy about. And here's what South Dakota Senator John Thune, also a possible presidential candidate, had to say in reply to that.
With regard to the economic issues, fiscal issues, I think most social conservatives agree that we want a government that's smaller, a government that's more responsive and accountable and all that. But we also need to recognize that there are important issues that impact the basic glue, the foundation that holds our culture together, and that comes down to the family unit, and we can't ignore those.
And we probably might disagree a little bit on this one, but I think you do have to have all of the above. Clearly the economic situation, and who knows exactly what the international scene is going to look like 2 years from now, but obviously there will still be major problems there. But it's almost impossible to intertwine them, especially when it comes to economic issues. You've got a lot of big government programs that have inadvertently discouraged ongoing nuclear family. You've got all sorts of programs that essentially reward single parenthood and all sorts of other things. That was not the plan, but that's where we are right now. And at the same time, you want to be able to maintain an American culture with some moral strength and to have that moral clarity in the world. And that begins not just in Washington, but it begins in strengthening the family, promoting a culture of life, and defending traditional values. I don't expect it to be the hallmark of the campaign of the 2012 nominee, given the huge challenges that are out there. But it obviously ought to be something, I think, that is something that matters a lot to them.
you're finding a complete agreement that the 2012 Republican nominee cannot be a social liberal. And in fact, it's kind of hard to believe that it would even be a social moderate. I mean, this person has to believe, has to have on their agenda pushing federal policies in a more conservative direction on these issues. However, when people start getting up in arms about Daniel's talk of a truce, and you know, so I can understand why social conservatives will look at this and say, hey, this sounds like a veiled suggestion that we don't matter as much, or that we're going to have to sit in the back and be quiet. But I would ask social conservatives, and I guess I'd ask every Republican or everybody who's contemplating a non-Obama choice in 2012, is look at the types of issues that will be rising to the forefront from January 2013 to the 4 years forward. You know, we can't perfectly predict the future, but it's very hard to imagine that we'll be in an economic easy street by then. And in fact, there's this great suspicion that, you know, we will have not only a economy that has not really rebounded and unemployment still, you know, a lot of people are talking the 8% range then, probably still going to have all this entitlement and fiscal crises upon us that you know, but if we haven't, if the next 2 years with Obama go badly, all of these problems are going to be exponentially worse. So that's going to be an enormous issue. And look, the world will continue to be a dangerous place 2 years from now, and probably a more dangerous place as a result of Obama policies that haven't worked out. Both of those things strike me as so enormous and so huge that even if you elected the most dedicated social conservative to the presidency, it's hard to imagine them being able to devote an enormous amount of time, resources, and issues and energy to those types of issues. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people are going to say this is a closeted call for a libertarian perspective or something. But just my observation is, look, we have some enormous problems in those two areas. And I want the next president to be able to solve these problems. And I think we've seen what Obama can do on this front. It's really not much of anything at all. And, you know, I think the president has to be willing to sell some difficult choices to the American public. You're not going to be able to win this with the traditional Republican message. And so when Mitch Daniels says that, he sounds a lot more reasonable to my ears. But obviously a lot of Republicans still yet to be persuaded of that.
Yeah. If you just look at the Reagan model, I think that's kind of what at least I'm looking for. Clearly, the lion's share of his oxygen was spent with recovering a horrific economy and winning the Cold War, and that's what he'll be remembered for. But at the same time, he was able to set that tone of moral clarity, not only in terms of economic and foreign policy, but also in the cultural vein. And that, I don't think most people, other than promoting certain policies as it relates to pro-life and traditional values, are asking a whole lot more than that. They just don't want someone who's going to be whistling past the graveyard while our culture continues to decline into the sewer. I think we're pretty much expecting the same.
There's not ordinarily I'd say we have to agree to disagree, but I don't think we disagree really that much, Greg.
No, I don't think we do at all. It's just a little bit different how we kind of arrive at the pretty much the same conclusion. So, Jim, enjoy your President's Day. I'm sure you have big plans, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Join us Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.